Without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jim Lindner on the stage, who's going to talk with a talk named Stained Glass. I'm sure it's going to be inspirational and maybe provocative.
Good morning. Let's see if we can get the slide up. Thank you very much. This is your question time, Dietrich. Okay. You're going to have to be fast on these questions, Dietrich. I'm going to put some water here so I don't spill it in my computer. I started doing computer animation in the late 1970s. That's how old I am. And this is before the IBM PC. And I had a whole bunch of artists working for me doing primitive things like this. And one of the things I discovered having computer animators work for me is that they would do literally this art. But when I went to their art shows, their own personal work, they were always doing sculpture. It seems so weird. You know, you're doing 3D computer graphics. Wow, you know. We're like the only people doing it. We're rendering pictures. And you know, when it comes to your own art, you're doing sculpture. Why is that? Well, I can understand it now. It's like 30 years later, I guess. And I've decided that all of this digital stuff leads, and all of working in film and video, it leads to a sensory deprivation. You know, you want to hold on to something. You know, all of these bits whirling around. You can't hold anything. It's just all stuff. And so I found that I needed to do something to harness this energy. And so I bought a church. I won't tell you what my family said. I can tell you what everyone asked. They said, well, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? That's what everyone said. Well, you're buying this church. What are you going to do with it? It never occurred to me to ask that. I mean, when I do restoration, when I work with clients for doing restoration of their stuff or preservation of their stuff, no one ever said, well, what are you going to do with it? You know, you're preserving it because you're preserving it. It's not because you want to do something else with it. But somehow when it comes to buildings, people think that the reason you want to preserve something is because you want to do something else with it. And I sort of stopped giving the answer, well, the truth, which was, well, I don't know. I just want to preserve it. Because that was not a very good answer, I guess. It works for film and video and audio, but it doesn't really work for buildings. Well, this church was what we call a fixer-upper. And maybe I should have known better. This church was on the market for 4 years, and none of the locals bought it, you know, the people who lived there. So I should have figured out maybe there was a reason. Maybe there was something they knew that I didn't. And there was a lot that they knew that I didn't. You can start looking there. That's wood rot. And this is one of the, in the basement, which we didn't, I had two architects who were friends of mine look at it. And, you know, we saw this post that held up a lot of the building on this rock. And it had been there for 110 years. So we figured, well, that's fine. We'll just kind of leave it that way. The building inspector, however, had different ideas about that. And so we had to replace all of the posts in the basement. But it had these beautiful stained glass windows. You walk into the space and it's light. You know, it just comes at you, the colors and the feeling, and it's just remarkable. And there's a certain feeling that I've always gotten with stained glass. I can't quite explain it. In some ways, maybe it's the silver light that people talk about with nitrate. It's a certain feeling that you get that overwhelms you when you are in an environment with stained glass. At least for me. And this church had lots of stained glass windows. It wasn't just one window. And so, you know, I was taken by the emotion, and it just seemed like such a wonderful thing. And so who could resist? I bought a church. I decided that I wasn't going to try to restore it, in the sense I'm not going to turn it back into a church. It had been deconsecrated 4 years ago, and I'm not a reverend. So I wasn't going to restore it in that sense, but I did decide that I wanted to preserve it. And a lot of things happened after I bought it. You know, when you buy things sometimes like that, you know, you sort of have emotional feelings and you really want to do something. And after you do the initial thing, you start looking a little more carefully. And I found out that actually I was fortunate in that the windows that I had purchased weren't just any old windows, but they were actually signed. And it turns out that stained glass windows are sort of the clip art of the period. These are 110 years old, roughly. Actually, there were stained glass window companies, and they would have certain designs and certain motifs that they would use throughout all of their windows that would sort of identify who they were and attract customers. If people liked a certain design, then they would go to their glass studio. Well, one of the things I started looking at after I bought it a little more carefully is some of the damage on some of the windows. And I didn't quite notice it that much before I bought it, but I started looking after. And I noticed that there were several of the windows had all sorts of damage. And if you look over here, for instance, you see there's a clear pane of glass, or it looks like it. If you look very carefully, you can actually see that there is image there, and that's the same exact image that is over here. There's no image here, and there's image over there. If you look over here, you'll see that there's a piece of glass that's missing. And so you see that this window is clearly damaged. I also realized that it is what it is. These windows are not, we're not in Notre Dame here. This is not the cathedral shark. This is a country church. And while these windows are unique, they're not very, very high value, very famous windows by any stretch of the imagination. And also what I realized is that the cost of preservation is most likely going to be far greater than the value of the windows. And here are two Gothic windows that I saw yesterday on eBay. And if you go to eBay, you'll see there's lots of windows because there's lots of churches that are being torn down. And stained glass windows right now are not in vogue. And so you can get yourself some very nice stained glass windows and this is the asking price is $1,250. So stained glass windows now are very expensive to preserve. But the intrinsic value or the value of the windows themselves is very low. Is this starting to sound familiar to any of you? Lo and behold, I found myself to be in the same position as some archives. Oh, my God. I've gone to the other side of the fence. I've been selling these people preservation for 20 years, and now I actually have inherited some myself. What am I doing? And I started going through the same thought process that a lot of archives do when they're talking about AV preservation. I started saying things like, well, they lasted for 100 years. I'm 56. They'll probably last for another 30. Do I really care beyond there? Do I really need to fix these windows? They look okay. No one ever looks at them. I have a lot of other financial priorities. I got two kids going to college. The cost of restoration is going to be greater than the value. And, the windows are just part of the building. We got all of this other stuff to deal with. I realized that now I own the archive, and now it's my money. It wasn't the client's money I'm spending. It's now my money. So I had to make a purchase or no purchase decision. What do I want to do? And then I had to do things like starting to evaluate vendors. I had to start thinking about preservation strategies, treatment strategies. And then I realized that I was the customer that I had been selling to and dealing with all of these years. And then I even had the same experience that they have when they talk with me, which is sticker shock. I don't know if any of you can read it here, but the total cost of doing these windows, the estimate, was $34,000. Now, I already showed you a slide that shows that two of them are worth $1,200, okay? So restoring them was $34,000. That was one vendor's estimate. That's the good news. The bad news is that it wasn't even for all the windows. But when I'm spending this kind of money, and I guess my customers do too, and archivists do too, I started really getting into it and started trying to understand, well, what is really going on here? Is the treatment plan appropriate? What is the money being spent on? And then I started really looking at the plan from the vendor, and I said, the plan started to seem inappropriate to me. They're replacing broken glass with a matching color. It's like, well, wait a second. This isn't a comic book. They said they want to divide the windows into smaller panels. It's sort of like taking apart a jigsaw puzzle, putting it back together again, but it's not going to be the same. Now, to me, as a preservation person, a digital preservation person, the idea of taking something, preserving it, and it's totally different from when it started was, you know, I mean, how could you even think of doing that? One of their proposals was to paint previous repairs to match the rest of the window. And after a while, I started saying, well, you know, this isn't really preservation here. They're talking about recreation, and I'm not sure that I'm really into that. But I started realizing all of a sudden that some of the things that I was learning very quickly apply to some of the work in AV. Now, one thing for sure is that clearly this is not a digital project. You know, and it's kind of funny because in AV media, certainly for the past 15 or 20 years, all we do is talk about digital this and digital that. Well, okay, fine. But, you know, digital preservation is not for everything, and it's certainly not for stained glass windows. You can make a reproduction, perhaps, digitally, but it certainly isn't the same artifact. Digital migration is kind of a meaningless concept for glass windows, right? I mean, what are you going to be migrating exactly? And ultimately, it comes down to what another person said before. The world is an analog place. You know, we're all analog, and it's probably going to be that way for the foreseeable future. I don't see any humans turning digital anytime in the future, nor will any wood or any molecules I know of turning digital. So some of the things that I started to get into, started to look at sort of sister fields and started to look at stained glass windows and conserving and art conservation of stained glass windows as having certain analogies to things that we do in AV preservation. I thought that everything that I knew was really inapplicable, but I was wrong. So what did I do? Well, I did probably what a lot of you people do. I just started to get educated. So I started to read articles. There's a lot of literature. People have been restoring windows for over 1,000 years. 1,000 years. We've been messing around for 50. Okay? People have learned a lot in 1,000 years. I found that there were some remarkable parallels between stained glass windows and AV preservation, even though they're separate media types. And I found that the technology of stained glass windows really goes back a long time. And they actually understand and have had an opportunity as a field to mature and to develop different skills and different approaches, which I'm going to suggest that are interesting to look at for our field. One of the things about windows and one of the things about film is that if you ask any filmmaker, well, what do they do? Usually the first thing they say is, well, I'm a storyteller. And stained glass windows are arguably the first purpose of stained glass windows was to tell a story. They were, of course, decorative. But they were called the poor man's Bible. This is a medieval period where most people were illiterate. And so most of the windows that were created were scenes from the Bible. People couldn't read, but they could see the scenes from the Bible. And those who could read, Bibles were, at that point, it was before printing. So they were very, very rare, very, very valuable, and very few people had access to them. And so windows tell the story, and these are two windows you can read. I'm not going to go into it, but here we have two panels from windows in this church, in St. Mark's Church. And here's an interpretation, and one of the things that we also know about stories is that they are open to interpretation. So this is an interpretation of these two windows by a stained glass restorer. I asked her to write her interpretation, understanding the history of stained glass and the perspective from an artisan's perspective. And then I actually asked a Lutheran reverend to do the same thing. And what I found, of course, is that while the windows were exactly the same, that they were open to interpretation, and that someone who is an artisan creating art versus someone who is a religious person could have a very different perspective. So not only do the windows tell the story, but the windows tell the story that can be interpreted in different ways. And I found that really interesting. Let me give you a little bit of nomenclature so that you have an understanding of some of the other similarities, which I find kind of interesting. Well, first of all, the glass itself is here in this cutaway, and you'll notice that it's in a carrier. And this carrier, in this case, is wood. The glass itself is actually flexible. Now, when I think of stained glass windows, I think of something that's really solid. They're up, they're so tall and everything. They're absolutely solid. Well, it turns out that they're not. And what keeps them up there is reinforcement. And there's reinforcement bars. There's actually two different types of bars. It doesn't really matter, except for the fact that these bars run across the windows, and the window is actually soldered. There's lead caming, which holds the panes of glass together, and this is actually soldered or wired to these reinforcing panels. And if you look at some of the windows here, you can actually see these lines, and it's funny because I never really noticed them when I was looking at the window, but of course, once you see it, it's always there. And you can look at the windows here and see that they all have this reinforcement. They're all here. Now, what you can sort of imagine over time is that, here's my point showing how windows are flexible. It's over at the end of a bench now. And you can actually see someone's holding it. She's going to put a light underneath it so that they can identify cracks. And we're going to see more of that before. But the point is that the glass itself is flexible. It's a flexible carrier. This blew me away. You know, I was standing there one day, and I'm looking at the thing. And obviously, it's larger than human scale. And I'm looking at it, and I go, oh, my God. This is cinema just the other way. And it turns out, now these are from the architect's drawings. They measured everything in this building. I had them do that. When you actually do it, the aspect ratio of the windows in St. Mark's Church is 1.54 and HD is 1.77. This is done 110 years ago. You know, I mean, is it a coincidence? Yeah, probably it's a coincidence, except it turns out that a lot of windows are like this. The aspect ratio is like that. Is there something about the human experience that kind of goes towards a 16:9 aspect ratio? I don't really know. But it's interesting that kind of feeling, that kind of widescreen feeling affects us, and it seems to have an impact on the way we see and the way we feel things. Stained glass is actually, some stained glass, the color is actually in the glass. But that's not all stained glass by any means. The way stained glass gets stained is that it's clear glass, which is made from silica, salt. And then metallic salts and oxides are put into the glass that give it its color. So some colors, depending upon the salts and depending upon the process necessary to mix them in, are very expensive to create. And so over time, they've come up with different kinds of techniques. Of course, if you wanted to create someone's face or grapes or anything else, you're not going to be able to do that with colored glass unless it's a mosaic-type technique. So what people developed over time were different types of techniques to start painting on glass. So here we have a flexible media type, which is essentially clear, which has paint on it that control the way the colors come through it. Okay? Starting to sound even more familiar. One of the things that's very interesting is that color space, if you will, of stained glass windows is a problem, just like it is in film and in video and everything else. And certain colors are very hard to reproduce and very expensive to reproduce. Red is one of those colors. In order to get a very deep, dark red, it was extremely difficult to fabricate and very, very expensive. And so they developed a technique called flashing. And what flashing is basically taking a piece of clear glass, making it, letting it cool, and then dipping it very quickly in a flash in molten red glass and taking it out. Now, does that sound similar to dyeing black and white film? It's almost an identical process. And you can see here broken piece of glass, it's not broken actually, what's happened is that it's gotten damaged and the red coat has actually come off of it. It's actually come away. It's delaminated itself from the clear glass that was underneath it. So the processes of delamination that occur over time in other types of media, the process of having media that is a layered media, where the medium itself acts as a filter through the glass in this case, or through base stock in the case of film, are similar. Some of the problems that you have on glass will also sound very similar. If you look at these clear glass panes that I mentioned before, and since I'm not wired to the podium, oh, this is so much fun. I feel like Madonna. You can go over here and see that these are clear. But if you go over here, you can see that, hopefully I won't feed back, okay? You see that they're painted here. Now, these were actually the same things. If you notice, they're symmetrical, right? And this one is here. Well, the reason is because it wasn't baked properly. And over time, the image actually faded away as it was exposed to the elements. Okay? You see that over here? This piece of glass, I didn't highlight it, is because that's actually a missing piece of glass. So the question comes up from a preservation point of view and a conservation point of view. Well, what do you do with those? Okay? Do you repaint them? Okay? What do you, you know, do you try to recreate them? What exactly do you do? Cracks are another problem, and this is, if you remember from that piece of video that I just showed you before of the glass being flexible and being pushed off, there was actually this window, and you'll notice on this window that there are cracks in it, and there is a main crack here, and there's a main crack right over here. Can everyone see that? Okay, this is an entire piece of glass that's cut out here, okay, so this is a very large piece of glass. We don't really know how that occurred. It could have been temperature. It could have been a physical thing that happened. It could have been, you know, the building settling. It could have been a number of different ways. But what do you actually do? Well, this is an area that stained glass people have been dealing with for a very long time. So what is the appropriate treatment? Do you leave it the way it is? Do you remove it and replace it with blank glass? Do you cement it? Do you repaint it? Well, this is what we did. What we actually did was we put more lead in between. And here you can see lead that actually has an adhesive backing being put down in the crack. And after it's put into the crack, it's pushed down and then burnished. And you'll see that in a second. It's actually pushed down with the end of an instrument, so that the adhesive and the lead is actually forced in between the cracks. It's covered with flux because what happens next is it gets soldered. And that's how it's fixed. Now, one of the really interesting parts of that is they have to be very careful so that the heat doesn't damage the glass. But one of the very interesting parts about it is that it's reversible. Okay, so we didn't take it out. We didn't try to fix it. Okay, what we tried to do was give it more integrity so that it wasn't going, so that the deterioration wasn't going to continue. So what can we learn from some of our stained glass experience? Well, first of all, many of the issues that we're dealing with now in our field are really part of standard practice in other fields. And I think that it's really time that we as a field start looking at art conservation very, very seriously and start adopting and adapting some of their approaches to ours. One of the main ones is ethics. There is a huge body of information, a huge body of knowledge of ethics that relate to how do you, if you will, migrate things, how do you preserve things, how do you restore things. These are just three of them, but there are dozens of different documents that have been generated over time by this field. One of the things that I found very interesting was that they are fanatics about documentation. And I have to say that when I started doing videotape restoration, that's something I started to do at the very beginning. And as a field, we don't really do a very good job with documentation. Documentation is a main part of what is done in art conservation. It's done before, during, and after treatment. And you can see here that there is extensive documentation down to measurements, down to what is done, how it's applied, if there are any problems in the application. And the idea is that these records travel or stay with the object over time. Solutions must be reversible. That's something we don't do very well in our field, I don't think. You know, someone comes out with the newest, coolest digital noise reduction. Oh, yeah, we'll use that. We don't really, you know, we talk reversible, but we don't walk the walk very much. No more secret sauce. Okay. Oh, yeah, well, how do they shrink the film? How do they get the film that was shrunk back? Oh, well, they have the secret magic sauce. They don't do that in art conservation. They rely on the fact that you're hiring me as a skillful practitioner. Okay, the techniques that I use are open. You can see what I use. You can use the chemicals that I use. You can do that because I am an artist and a technician, and it's my skill that makes it work. It's not the magic sauce. And that's something that I think, frankly, is a real problem in our field. Solutions have to be appropriate to the need, meaning that just because you have the technology doesn't mean you should use it. Similar processes of deterioration occur in many objects other than just film. And, you know, we live in a physical universe, and we need to apply them as well. So, I've saved 5 minutes. I want to thank, and of course, there's a large body of information here. My goal here was to sort of tickle your imagination and to sort of say, gee, well, maybe we should look at how people are preserving other types of art forms and other things, and maybe start applying that to our thinking using digital technology. I want to thank the nice people at Cranberry Glass in Nova Scotia, Canada, Laurie Nason and Penny Beadle. They're the people actually doing the restoration. They're not the first vendor that came to me that gave me that estimate. The reason I hired them is because they're really excited to do the project, and they wanted to apply their knowledge. This is the first time they've done a project on this scale. But they wanted to apply the technique and the knowledge they had to do something on a scale that they had never done before. And so they were enthusiastic, they were knowledgeable, and they had the right attitude. And for me, that was the reason I gave them the job. I also want to thank the Reverend Gunther Dahl and the Reverend Mark Harris, who actually looked at some of the interpretations that we've done of the church to check them for accuracy. So I have time for question, right? Quick, one or two quick questions. Come on, I'm under time. This is a good thing. Dietrich, you have to ask a question now. Come on. I did it for you. You said...
I will approach you. Thank you for this very basic and very fundamental story. It is a story.
Yes.
Where we can learn a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that was Dietrich saying that he'll contact Jim when he buys a church. and I would like to thank you for delving into, what shall we say, our tall screen continuity in cultural preservation and restoration. I don't know, do we have one quick question more? No, we have a mic ready. No, okay. We'll go on to the next speaker then. Thank you, Jim.
Sure.